This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, we have $34 billion of tariffs going into effect this week on Chinese goods, ranging from farming equipment, semiconductors, airplane parts, and more. But nevertheless, the markets seem to be puttering right along despite all of that. Hi, everybody. I'm John Loeffler. Jim Poplava is out this week, but never fear, much to hear right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Ryan Poplava will be on deck first to discuss what moved the markets this week, along with a technical update on stocks, particularly the emerging markets and bonds, commodities, and currencies. And then Chris Sheridan and Ryan Sweet from Moody's will survey the U.S. economy, the employment report this week, and also how long they think this economic cycle is going to last, and whatever else comes to mind that's of import that our listeners should hear. And then during the big picture, well, emerging markets are almost down 8% right now. That's in the first half of 2018. Developed markets outside the U.S. down 4.5%. If we look at the emerging market currencies, they're down big this year. And you know, bonds haven't done very well either. About the only thing going up so far are the FANG stocks. All of that is subject of conversation with Chris Poplava from Financial Sense Wealth Management, what this means in terms of the big picture, and of course, your investments. And that's on the big picture, and also rethinking retirement. You want to understand the impact of the gig economy, because with the advancement of technology, we're beginning to see more opportunities being created for people to work in the rapidly growing gig economy, as it is called. All of that coming up today, right here on the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we always do at the first part of the program, we go to Ryan Poplava, who theoretically talks about the catalysts and drivers moving the financial markets this week. So, Ryan, being theoretical, what can you tell us about the status of the ongoing trade war now that it seems to be erupting and getting into full gear here?
Well, theoretically and practically, it's surprising because things are actually going really well for the U.S. despite all the back and forth, all the headlines. And we've had some recent weakness here as it's appeared that the trade war is escalating a little bit. There's been quite a bit of tweets from Trump on that. But for the most part, the planned $34 billion of tariffs went into effect on July 6th. And essentially it's on the Chinese goods, and that's going to range from farming equipment, semiconductors, airplane parts, and more. China, of course, immediately plans to impose a 25% increase of tariffs on around 545 U.S. products worth around the same amount, you know, $34 billion, which is what the World Trade Organization said they can do. You can retaliate equally. And so that's going to be on agricultural goods, whiskey, and of course, big SUVs, what we're known for. But both the U.S. and the Chinese are considering a follow-up tariff of around $16 billion. Originally, Trump had talked about around $50 billion. But what's the most interesting news item to me this week is a Reuters article that President Trump told reporters on Air Force One yesterday that subsequent rounds of tariffs could be applied on $550 billion worth of Chinese goods in total. So we're going to be nearing 50. He's going to add a potentially another half a trillion. And that investors kind of shook that off on Friday, which I was really amazed about. I'm not sure if investors are really pricing in that because, again, we didn't really respond. We didn't correct a 1% to 2% on Friday, but instead rallied off of strong economic news. But you know, I don't know if they're really just kind of blowing smoke, because while the Deutsche Bank has modeled tariffs to this extent could add around a half a percent to our GDP, because of course we're adding money to their products and that's going to the U.S. government. But there are unintended consequences, and they measured that with around 0.4% from higher prices, about a half a percent from retaliatory tariffs, and then about another 1% to hit business confidence. All told, net, we'd be down 1.5% in GDP from tariffs ranging from that. So interestingly, and like I said, a rally did begin on Thursday ahead of the mandated tariffs and continued right into Friday. It was a broad-based rally all sectors higher. And that may have been from another trade catalyst that occurred on Thursday that provided some of the confidence in a report from Politico that the EU was considering a plurilateral trade deal to eliminate tariffs on autos. Now, the deal would have to cover, from what I'm reading, around 90% of global car exports to the EU to be able to meet the World Trade Organization rules. It also could have been from just, like I said, the wide spectrum of positive economic announcements we got in the U.S. all week long that stemmed the tide, I would say, this week. And that started with the manufacturing ISM on Monday and ended with the jobs report on Friday. That all seemed to really encourage investors to buy the dip that we've experienced these past couple of weeks.
Well, it does still sound, as Jim was talking about, that the United States continues to be the best house in a bad neighborhood. This is the theme, of course, that Jim ran many years ago during the recovery, while Europe was still suffering through its sovereign debt crisis that peaked from, 2010 to 2012. And, you know, it is the first week of the month when we have some key economic announcements. So let's change the spotlight here. Let's dig into some of those results, starting with the manufacturing ISM figure.
Yeah, it really did stem the tide. Like I said, we were negative in the morning. Then the manufacturing ISM came out. It was strong to 60.2, is up about 1.5 points for May. Now, it's looking like this was strongly influenced by supplier deliveries, which went from 62 to 68 points, the highest since May of 2004, which may be the result of supply side strain, I'm reading from some economists, caused by tariffs. And like we've been seeing almost all year, the prices paid component is elevated right now at about 76.8, with comments from many of those that were surveyed centering on strong demand. Okay, we know that, with concerns over tariffs. Oh, that's new. And difficulty in supply constraints. And essentially the other issue with labor is finding skilled labor. It was a very strong number. We've been up towards 60. I think the last time was around February, but it's just been very strong. Now, the services ISM number came out on Thursday, and that followed in sync with what we're seeing in the manufacturing ISM. It was higher, up about 1.5 points to 59.1. And it hasn't shown any plans to reverse the trend yet, with new orders up solidly and an activity index that was up to around 63.9. That's the highest actually since August of 2005, just to give you an idea of how strong the manufacturing base is right now. Now, the activity in both the ISM services and the manufacturing really concretely puts the U.S. as the best looking house in the bad neighborhood, as Jim puts it. But looking at the data, if you pull out the sheet and you look at a full decade of where these readings have fallen in between, 60 has been a buffer in the past. And that's where we've seen the index peak in 2005. Also in 1998, towards the end of the business cycle. So that's something to really be conscientious of, that how much more stronger can we get from here? And as you know, the market doesn't move off of what is happening right now. It moves off of expectations. So as long as those expectations, as those surveys continue to have good prints, we'll continue higher. But like I said, this has been the high point many times before. Now, some of the other information that came out this week, John, the May factory orders rebounded more than expected, up about 0.4% month over month. And the jobs report was solid, came in about 213,000 added jobs in June. The unemployment rate increased. That wasn't a bad thing. This time it was looked at as a good thing because it meant that more people were entering in the workforce, encouraged by the economy, how well things are going with obviously the tax cuts and higher wages. You know, the average hourly earnings increased slightly. That was the other side of this. It was looked at as a kind of a Goldilocks type of a reading because great jobs report, jobs were added, but we didn't see huge increase in our average hourly earnings. Some economists don't really like that reading. Some also would prefer to rather look at the employment cost index, which has accelerated recently due to a tightening labor market.
Well, U.S. economy is strong like bull, comrade.
Strong like bull.
That's not bull either. Anyway, great news. Hopefully it can lift stocks out of the trading rage we've been in all year due to trade woes. You know, but yeah, we'll see. I mean, this is something that we have to wait and see if it really pulls out of that. Okay, moving on. Anything else you'd like to share about this week's financial news?
There were quite a few events, a lot of political events, a lot of things going on over in Europe. Brexit still continues. There were some meetings there with May on trade and over with Merkel on immigration, shoring up her party. That's really important because if there's a lack of confidence, we saw it in Italy, right? A couple of months ago where the parties have been split and there was talks of new elections, even talks of a more populist view of possibly looking at a referendum and leaving the EU. So politics are really important on the markets there. But no, I think the most important event this week, besides a lot of the trade talk, has been the verbal intervention by the People's Bank of China. And that's been to shore up the Chinese yuan. In addition to the June Caixin composite PMI for China that lifted to 53 for June, up from 52.1. Mind you, that has been in a downward trend, so a little bit of reprieve there. So the yuan had fallen for around 10 out of the last 12 days before rallying towards the end of the week. And that was from a couple of members from the People's Bank of China chiming in. There was a verbal intervention, if you want to call it that. So looking at June, the yuan was down around 3.3%. And that's the worst month for the currency since the FX market was established in 1994, just to give you an idea of the magnitude here. And then also looking at how deep of a correction that was, something similar happened in 2015, which led to a major market correction in risk markets here and abroad. And again, in January 2016, when we feared that they were again readjusting the peg of the yuan versus the dollar. And that, mind you, also, it wasn't just the currency. That was more of a symptom of a sickness that manufacturing had, that the Chinese economy had been slowing. Capital had been leaving China at that time, again, because of that weakness of the currency as well. So obviously, as the trade war continues to heat up on kind of both sides between our two countries, a strong dollar and a weakening in some of the manufacturing surveys over the past several months, you know, the currency has just been in trouble, John. And so, like I said, we had some officials chime in, and I've got some of that information here. We had the People's Bank of China Governor Yin Gan said that the bank will keep the yuan exchange rate basically stable at reasonable and balanced levels. But there was also the head of the People's Bank of China's Financial Research Institute. His name is Sun, S-U-N. And he added a lot more color, had a lot more to say, saying that the weakness lately has been entirely due to change in market expectations as external uncertainties rise rather than intended guidance of the central bank, adding that China upholds multilateralism, globalization, free trade, and rule-based international guidelines and will not make the yuan's exchange rate a tool to cope with trade conflicts. So they clearly wanted to shore up confidence that the Chinese are not resorting to a currency war now on top of a trade war to combat the US. But honestly, John, I think allowing the yuan to depreciate will neutralize the effects of the tariff. And this is probably known by the Bank of China. If you look at the chart, there was a clear rally in the currency right after Trump took office, probably to stave off complaints about how maybe they have predatory practices. But now that we're moving full forward into a trade war, intervention may be a tool that they are using. And of course, they've got to save face. This is the thought kind of held by many in our office.
You know, and what is amazing about the whole thing, there's been a lot of chatter in the popular media about the trade war. But what is amazing with all of this, trade wars, tariff, right now it's back and forth. It hasn't blown into full-blown activity yet. Currency volatility, you were talking about it, and inflation, the U.S. stock market is holding up well in the middle of it all.
It is. And that's, I think, largely, we've talked about it on the show, it's the tax cuts that were made. It's not typical to have fiscal policy this strong towards the end of a bullish cycle. And so that's kind of given us a lot of essentially support. Earnings have been strong, projected, I believe, up 20% estimated for the end of this year for the S&P earnings. But the S&P 500 and the Dow Industrials aren't up very much if you still consider the low single digits very strong, because it's not, but it is better than being negative. Many other markets are negative this year. Of course, we've talked about the 20% correction from the highs for China, as well as the emerging markets. So look at the NASDAQ and look at the Russell 2000. There you're seeing where the value has been more realized from that economic growth, the earnings growth, and the moderate inflation. But it's clear, John, that if you look at the bond market, the bond market has been wise over events with a flat yield curve and a risk-off appetite if you look at what's happened in the high-yield markets versus treasuries.
All right, Ryan Poplava, thank you for the market wrap. As always, we'll stay tuned next week for your review when we begin the second quarter earnings season on Friday with the banks. But, oh, wait a minute. Our technician's coming up next, and strangely enough, he looks just like you do, Ryan. We'll be back as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at FinancialSense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Unfortunately, a lot of the threats that we've seen recently, particularly in the case of the trade war, it's talk here and there, and we found it's sometimes very hard to quantify political risk of this sort. And the result of that, specifically with respect to the trade stat, was this construction of a global trade monitor. And so what we did with this monitor was we gathered a combination of global data series specifically related to trade that we think could give us a signal as to whether trade globally is truly dissipating. So if you look at the latest reading in the monitor, weight of the evidence, we're seeing some deterioration on the survey-based end, but most of the hard data is still holding up. So I would say at this point, we haven't seen the entire global trade sphere fall into chaos, but there are some areas of concern that we need to be watching.
And welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour. And it's time for our look at the technicals. Ryan Poplava joining us again here for this. So as we've already discussed in the previous segment, Ryan, the United States has been holding its own versus many other foreign equity markets. And I remember last week on the market wrap-up, you mentioned others like the Shanghai Stock Composite and some emerging market ETFs are in a bear market with about 20% corrections or more. So let's start with that.
Yes, I mentioned that last week, but also that many of these areas are oversold and they are due for a bounce. We saw some of that this week, and it wouldn't surprise me if that does last maybe another week, maybe two. It really depends if we get some catalysts, if there is some negotiation that does take place on the trade side of things, that could really help. But make no mistake, John, these are top formations. So it wouldn't surprise me if we come back up to where these patterns broke down, test them, hold and continue the trend down. I mean, that's what tops are. If we're able to get some negotiations and we rally strongly, we just saw the Chinese PMI was up for June. If that trend reverses and assists here, of course, the People's Bank of China are also lowering reserve requirements and doing everything they can to also stimulate things there as well. We've seen the yuan depreciate. These should all have positive effects going forward. But unless we're able to get back above these key support levels that have been broken, we've got a top here. If we do break out above that and reverse these patterns, then we call that a whipsaw signal. And we've seen that before, but we'll just have to see how things play out. But, you know, they're bearish patterns right now.
For the benefit of listeners, what is a whipsaw signal?
Well, it's when a pattern completes. You call it a pattern completing when it forms and then eventually breaks down or breaks out above a key level, like a resistance or a support level, depending bearish or bullish, and then reverses in a very short time. That would be a whipsaw.
Okay, that makes sense. All right, but as it stands now, these are bearish patterns in Chinese and emerging market stocks, and investors in that area should be cautious.
They should. If they're in that area, you know, it's best to use stop losses. I tend to get out when I start to see topping formations. And I did do that in my Chinese exposure earlier this year around February and March. But, you know, the reason for the caution, John, is that while we are the best house in a bad neighborhood, like I said, as Jim calls it, we're not uninfluenced by a slowdown abroad. Eventually, it affects us too because of globalization. We're connected. I'm including a chart in a chart pack that we'll put on the website for many of these things we're going to discuss here, which will show that corrections in the MSCI World Index, excluding the US, has led many of the corrections in the S&P 500 over the past 3 years. And that started back in the mid-2014 correction that eventually led a year later to a correction in the S&P 500 and in 2015. And you can see that clearly on the chart. And also that it has begun again here recently with all the weakness abroad. You know, there's also the global JP Morgan PMI, which has been in a downtrend and is following in sync with these markets. So it's not just trade related. It's actual economically related. And there's no indication that it will happen again, of course, you know, and that's my compliance background talking there, but it is a big glaring red flag for me. And history might not always repeat itself, but it often rhymes, as they say.
Now, you've already mentioned how important it was this week, but what does your chart work tell you about the yuan?
Well, the yuan is undergoing another corrective depreciation process that started a few months ago. It was strengthened initially last year. Like I said, I think it was politically oriented to kind of dissuade the current administration from kind of going after their, as they put it, predatory practices. But it's clear this year, once, I like this word again, it was clear, we were moving forward with tariffs directly on China, that, you know, the currency has been allowed to depreciate clearly to favor their trade, to combat the effect of tariffs and an all-out trade war, which their leaders have said they're ready for. We may see an oversold bounce. You know, nothing goes straight down. Nothing goes straight up. We have reversions to the mean. And that could be based on all that Chinese verbal intervention that we got this week. But the long-term trend is down. That began several months ago, and it favors them to allow it, right? I've seen some predictions so far from some economists and viewers of the market that we'll see something between 6.8 or maybe 7 by the end of this year for the yuan versus the dollar, where we're currently at around 6.6 now.
All right, moving on from China and the emerging markets, let's talk about U.S. stocks. The S&P 500 is up 3.2% year to date, but that is not where all the gains have been. It's been in the NASDAQ and the Russell 2000. So here in the U.S., how do things look for you?
Well, if we're breaking performance down between the sectors, tech and consumer discretionary sectors have been leadership, and they continue to really be the case today. I've been bullish on consumer discretionary stocks ever since I got a buy signal back in November. We talked about on the podcast when I related some of the very strong holiday season results right after Thanksgiving. And I'm even investing in non-internet retailers because many have changed the strategy to include that online presence to compete, obviously, against the likes of Amazon. But the first quarter earnings report had many retailers printing just solid gains, John. And of course, there's Amazon, which is part of the consumer discretionary group. And that's part of that very popular FANG group, Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google. Of course, there's a few more names now in that acronym. That name keeps getting a little bit bigger, but that's a group that's been working. And then, of course, tech. You know, tech has just been very strong all year. A lot of the concentration in both tech and consumer discretionary is the feeling that these are areas that would be able to avoid some of the trade wars, that, you know, they're not going to put tariffs on our intellectual property. They're doing it on our agricultural goods, our airplanes, and like I said, our large SUVs. But consumer discretionary continues to outperform the one area of the market, consumer staples. And that's been one of my risk on indicators that has been just solid and in force since the market bottomed in 2016. I haven't seen a reversal there. And that's why I've, throughout the market correction we had in February and March, and you could even call us, we're still in this kind of sideways consolidation, we're not seeing just a flight to de-risk. We're not seeing the market rotate into utilities. We're not seeing it rotate into consumer staples. or healthcare. It's been mainly in these growth-oriented areas. So that's why I felt that we're still in this risk-on mode for stocks in general. So while these two areas, consumer discretionary and technology, have been leadership, there have been some pullback opportunities here in the last 2 weeks as the market has pulled into support. Micron kind of led the charge this week, bouncing back from China's ban on some of the company's products because they said it wouldn't really affect them much. They said it would maybe only impact 1% of annual revenue. So they kind of led the charge. Tech is leadership, so that was a good thing this week. Healthcare, I believe, should be upgraded. And that's because of a recent breakout kind of caused by Biogen's Alzheimer's successful trial on Friday, which boosted the whole group, helped break things out on the near term. And when I'm looking at the group, around 73% of the components of that healthcare sector in this S&P 500 are now trading above their 200 exponential moving average. And whenever I see that go above 60%, to me, that's a buy signal. On top of the bullish breakout in the pattern, it looks pretty good. Needs to be upgraded. And you want to continue to watch, like I said, the leadership in technology because it's the largest weighting in the S&P 500. All right, so healthcare, financials, consumer discretionary. The other area to watch now on the opposite side of the spectrum is financials. Financials have been weak. They've been suffering due to weak loan growth, as was reported in the first quarter earnings season, as well as a flat yield curve. That's, as we keep saying every week, is flatter than a pancake. We're now to levels that we haven't seen in like about a decade. So you want to continue to watch the financials. If they break down, I haven't seen that yet, but if they do, that would be very bad for stocks. It's the second largest group in the S&P 500.
You know, not all pancakes are flat either. You know, German pancakes and Norwegian.
I love German pancakes.
Yeah, right, where they're curled up in on themselves and you got sugar and all sorts of diabetic causing type
lemon.
Things. Yeah.
Okay. We put some lemon in it.
So that's not a very good analogy. I mean, you know, so you have a market that curls up on the side. Anyway. All right. So tech had a pullback opportunity here and is still leadership with consumer discretionary close behind. Are you watching financials, whether they roll over? I mean, let's turn to bonds too. As you mentioned, the yield curve is flat and that's hurting financials. So what else can you tell us about the asset class?
You're right. Financials are still the place to be watching. They are on my kind of warning list. And that's an area I've been invested in because I did believe that rates were headed higher this year. And they did initially, but obviously the trade wars have kind of put things back. It's been a constant tug of war between the strong U.S. economics, expectations over inflation, and we've seen wage inflation this year, it's moderate, and also over central bank policy expectations. Mind you, back in June, we had the Fed announce that they're going to do 4 rate hikes instead of 3. They didn't announce it, rather, but if you look at their expectations for what's going to happen by the end of this year, more voting members were giving us their thoughts in the dot plot that it would be 4 rate hikes and not just 3. So from an investment standpoint, there's been weakness overall if we're looking at the bond asset class in high yield. And that's been the case since mid-2017. It's been trading in a very narrow range since the market bottomed in February. Mind you, a lot of stocks headed higher, right? So NASDAQ was heading higher to new all-time highs. And that wasn't being confirmed by a rising trend in high yield. That's something that I watch to kind of confirm each other. So that's one area of the market that has been weak. But of course, that's probably mostly influenced by rising interest rates. But there's just been no inflection yet. We have seen a little bit of a rally this week, but that will be something to watch on the near term. I'm seeing a possible top in the 10-year treasury bond yield with support right now around 2.8%. Remember, we did get above 3% briefly. That has created what we would call a head and shoulder pattern. Head and shoulder patterns happen at every single reversal. You get a higher high, higher low, lower high, lower low, which is different from the previous trend. So that does create those head and shoulder patterns. We do have that on the near term in the treasury yield. If it falls below, we could be testing that range around 2.5%. Maybe at that point, going through that whole process could lead to a bond rally across the board. And that might be because I've started seeing some of the Fed members back away in the last couple of weeks from that 4 rate hike discussion. I mentioned it last week. I forget which Fed governor you could dial back on the wrap up last week, But like I said, last week, I think they were just too aggressive in their June outlook. You know, they're looking solely at the U.S. There was barely any mention of trade. You look at the Fed minutes that came out this week, they talked about trade. So, you know, we're seeing them kind of dial back there, and that could influence why the long-term yields might be coming down here. Additionally, I'm hearing ECB policymakers are uneasy that investors aren't betting on an interest rate hike until December 2019. That was something, that was a headline this week, which means the market took just way too dovish of a view on rates from their most recent policy statement last month. Turning to currencies, real quickly here, John, the two communications, so the Fed backtracking and then the ECB saying, oh, you guys are a little too dovish, I think is going to cause some near-term weakness for the dollar and a rally in the euro, especially because the euro is at some very critical support here, right in that range between 117 to 118 versus the dollar.
Right. Before we go here, too, by the way, we've covered most of the major markets, but would you please talk about commodities and the real key areas that you're focusing on?
That's gold, John. I've actually dipped my toes in for some of my clients, and that's mainly because I'm concerned about the possibility, as I've mentioned many times over the past couple of weeks and previously, about a currency crisis. Given some of the weakness I'm seeing in currencies pegged to the dollar, the yuan just being one really big one. Turkey's inflation CPI just printed recently showing an annual reading of around 12.15%. If their recent 2.6% rise month over month. So annual rate of 12, month over month, 2.6. Couple that with hyperinflation in Venezuela, Argentina at around 23%. And there are some real possibilities of a currency crisis. So that's why I'm taking a little bit of a dip here in gold. Gold is also near some near-term support and has been basing now for a couple of years and has not been able to break out of that just yet. We don't see the hyperinflation just yet for the US and many other areas. It's mainly been attributed to those currencies pegged against the dollar. And we've seen that before many times, right? So trade wars, tightening central banks, they've all played into some of the issues there. Copper and other base metals were hit hard this week, and I think due for a corrective bounce, but that is a cause for concern. But it's not puzzling, John, because like I said, if you look at the JP Morgan Global PMI, that's been falling for several months now, and those metals are very sensitive to world economics, emerging market growth expectations. And that's why we're seeing, I think, finally the weakness in those areas, whereas they were very strong at the end of last year and the very, very beginning of this year. And I think we will see base metals and deep cyclicals eventually come back and kind of be in fashion. But I don't think that's going to be until we see more of resolve to trade. We see a pickup in those global PMIs again. And I don't see that in the near term. That could be later on in the second half and maybe the first half of 2019. We'll have to see. Eventually, if you look at it from a sector rotation standpoint, your asset classes go like this. You have weakness in bonds, then in stocks, then in commodities. We've seen some weakness in bonds and high yield, especially peaked so far last year. Stocks, we haven't seen the top yet there for the US, possibly for the world MSCI index. Who knows? We'll have to continue to watch that. And then finally, commodities top. So that's the typical order. I think there still may be some play in here, but that's only if we get a resolve on the trade war issues here. But as I've mentioned before, both sides are digging in and planning for a much longer term war here, not just a skirmish.
And that's going to take time to emerge as we see it. All right, Ryan Poplava, thank you for doing both the market wrap and for being our technician this week. And Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.
Should you buy and hold at a market top? At Financial Sense Wealth Management, we believe valuations, leading economic indicators, and other metrics are essential for prudent investing to both identify long-term opportunities and minimize risk. Every day, we keep a watchful eye on the markets, continually assessing the investment landscape so you can focus on the things you love most. Don't put your hard-earned wealth at risk.
Give us a call at Financial Sense Advisors. Call toll-free 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA, SIPC. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
That's giving you a message, I think. The markets themselves are giving you a message of an America which is doing okay to probably quite well, and the rest of the world, particularly emerging markets, that continue to struggle. And that really is at the core of the call for this, what I think is a breakdown in the global monetary system. The world simply can't live with an America that grows this way. And what do I mean by that? What I mean by that is, at least at the moment, an America which is growing without blowing out its current account deficit. That is why people linked to the dollar in the past. Of course, Europeans don't do it. The Japanese don't do it. The British, the Australians, the Canadians don't do it. But the emerging markets have done it. And they have linked their growth to America on the basis that America will run large current account deficits. It did reach almost 6% of GDP in 2007. But since the GFC ended, it has not exceeded 2.5% of GDP. It is now 2.3% of GDP. So that's a fundamental reason why everybody has to reconsider their link to the dollar. And China in particular, of course, because it's the world's second biggest economy, and therefore it matters.
Joining us on the show today is Ryan Sweet, Director of Real-Time Economics at Moody's Analytics, and also ranked as one of the most accurate high-frequency forecasters of the U.S. economy, according to MarketWatch. Ryan, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, Ryan, I want to ask you about something that just came across my desk from the chief economist at Gluskin Sheff, David Rosenberg. He says that regarding what we saw today with the employment data, he says, if it wasn't for the official launch of a global trade war, the stock market would be soaring on today's employment report. What do you think of that? Is the employment report, first of all, that good? And do you think that the stock market would be responding much higher if it weren't for a lot of the trade war talk that's going on right now?
Yeah, well, first on the employment numbers, across the board, they were really impressive. I mean, we're creating, on average, about 215,000 jobs per month this year, compared to roughly 180,000, 185,000 in a comparable period in 2017. So job growth has accelerated over the past year or so. Job gains are fairly broad-based. The unemployment rate's trending lower now. It ticked up in June from 3.8% to 4%, but the unemployment rate rose for the right reason, in that we had a little bit more than 600,000 people enter the labor force. And that's an encouraging sign, and that's a signal of improved confidence in the labor market. Maybe stronger wage growth is pulling more people into the labor force. So all in all, I'm not too concerned about the increase in the unemployment rate. Wage growth, a little bit disappointing, but we're still on track to continue to see further acceleration, because the unemployment rate has nowhere to go but lower, because household employment growth is outpacing labor force growth. Therefore, just mathematically, the unemployment rate over time is going to continue to trend lower. We have it ending this year a little bit south of 3.5%, which would be among the lowest since the 1960s. So this job market's going to be very, very tight this year, and it's going to get even tighter in 2019. Now, with regards to the stock market, I think, you know, first, this was a good report from the Fed. It, you know, doesn't justify them raising rates more aggressively. It doesn't justify them easing off the throttle or cutting back on the amount of rate hikes that they would follow through with this year or early next. So it was kind of like a sweet employment report for the Fed. The stock market, I think the trade tariffs are clearly weighing on investor sentiment. Now, underlying economic fundamentals, corporate profit growth as well, all justify, you know, further gains in the stock market through the rest of this year. It's just, I think these trade tensions are going to remain a cloud that hangs over investors' heads for some time.
Let's talk about the high frequency GDP model that you have at Moody's that I know that you track very closely. What is that saying about the trajectory of the U.S. economy at present? And where do you see things heading? You did just point out that the job market is very tight. You think it'll be getting tighter in 2019. Overall, it sounds like the outlook is still fairly positive for 2018. What's your model telling you?
Yeah, so our high frequency GDP model, we update it each business day and essentially calculates what GDP is on track to be in the current quarter. Now, we're still tracking second quarter GDP because all the puzzle pieces haven't been released yet for the second quarter. But right now we have GDP tracking 3.9% at an annualized rate, which is good. I mean, that's well above the economy's potential growth rate, which, you know, we probably put closer to 1.5 to 2%. So the economy is growing clearly above its potential growth rate. You know, that justifies, you know, further tightening in the labor market, reduction in slack, stronger wage growth, and a little modest upward pressure on inflation. But overall, I mean, the data that we've received this week on vehicle sales, the ISM surveys, the employment data, all suggest that the economy has gathered momentum towards the end of the second quarter. So we're heading into the second half of this year with a number of tailwinds. And the big boost from the fiscal stimulus, so corporate tax cuts, personal income tax cuts, increased government spending, that's still ahead of us. We're going to get that big boost in the second half of this year. So we think GDP growth will average above 3% in the second half of this year, roughly that in 2019. And then we're going to get a fiscal hangover in 2020. And that's when the economy will really begin to slow. But for the next year and a half, it's going to be smooth sailing for the economy. It's going to take a lot to derail the U.S. economy, just given the amount of fiscal stimulus that we have in the pipeline. But these growing trade tensions is a little bit of cause for concern. But again, I mean, it would have to escalate very quickly and transition from a trade skirmish into a trade war to really have a more noticeable impact on the economy's performance over the next 6 to 12 months.
Okay. So as you just stated, given where the trade war or trade skirmish is presently, as long as that doesn't escalate too far, the base case for the U.S. economic outlook is for things to be maintaining current growth for the rest of this year, 2019, still generally positive, but not seeing any signs of a rollover in the U.S. economy. And please clarify if you mean a recession in 2020. Do I gather that correctly? Is that kind of the base case that you have currently?
Yeah, that's correct. And economists have a very difficult time in forecasting recessions. But I think the economy will be more at risk of a recession in 2020 because this fiscal stimulus, the boost that we're going to be receiving is going to be fading in 2020. The Fed's going to continue to be raising interest rates. The Fed funds rate will be above the long run equilibrium Fed funds rate in 2020. So overall, fiscal policy will be a drag on GDP growth. Monetary policy will be slowing the economy down. So therefore, we're going to feel these headwinds really come to fruition in 2020. Now, doesn't mean a recession is a slam dunk. Right now, if you look throughout the economy, there's no glaring imbalances. So household balance sheets are in very good shape. Non-financial corporate balance sheets are in good shape. The financial system's balance sheet is in good shape. So, you know, there's no glaring imbalances, which would suggest that a recession is imminent, meaning 2018, 2019. But I do think, you know, the economy is going to begin to show more evidence of overheating towards the end of 2019. And then I think in 2020, the economy is going to slow pretty abruptly. And then that's when we're going to be very susceptible to any exogenous shock. So a sudden tightening in financial market conditions, or a geopolitical event, or if these trade tensions continue to escalate.
Okay, so in that case, I mean, if that outlook is correct, that we're not going to see any real slowing until 2020, I take it that would mean that this economic cycle is going to end up being one of the longest, if not the longest, that we've seen so far, rivaling even what we saw with the 10-year expansion culminating with the tech bubble.
Correct, yeah. This is going to be the longest expansion on record because, you know, given the fiscal stimulus, I mean, it's going to take a lot to derail it this year or next. So I think we're going to hit a milestone. And, you know, this expansion was, it took some time to gather momentum, but, you know, the economy is firing on almost every cylinder. You can see it across all aspects of the economy. The, you know, labor market is in very good shape. The housing market is improving. And, you know, I just think the next couple of years, we should see very solid GDP growth. Now, the issue is that the growth that we're going to get over the next couple of years isn't sustainable because the economy's potential growth rate is a function of two things, labor force growth and productivity growth. And productivity growth has been a big disappointment for much of this expansion. And even though the tax legislation should create some incentive for businesses to invest in equipment and software and research and development, things that should help productivity, that takes time. It takes 2 to 3 years from when businesses invest in equipment, software, R&D to really affect productivity. So we're not going to see a significant turnaround in productivity growth for some time. Therefore, the economy's potential growth rate, which usually the economy fluctuates around in the medium term, is going to remain depressed. And that means, you know, the fiscal stimulus that the Trump administration imposed is unlikely going to significantly alter the economy's long run potential. We're just going to be on a little bit of a sugar high for the next couple of years. But in the end, the economy will be no better off in the long run with the fiscal stimulus than if there wasn't any fiscal stimulus.
Okay. Now you mentioned us being in a sugar high because of this fiscal stimulus, the tax cuts also going into effect. When we think about the evidence of overheating that you think is going to start really being reflected in 2019, at present, it sounds like you don't think that the Fed is going to be putting too much pressure on the markets given where current inflation is. But the idea that the Fed could be start leaning in, I know that was something that Jerome Powell mentioned, that should be something that we should start being worried about more in the latter half of 2019, perhaps?
That sounds about right. I mean, the Fed, I think so far, has done an excellent job. I mean, they've been able to raise interest rates and without undermining financial market conditions or the broader economy. I mean, the Fed, when they look around, they have a unemployment rate at 4%. Inflation is near their 2% objective. So they likely view the economy as being in this sweet spot. Now, the trick is the Fed has to try to keep the economy there. In other words, they're trying to land this plane perfectly on a tarmac, and that's very difficult to do. And the Fed really is going to be paying attention to a few things. First is inflation, and they're going to allow inflation to run a little bit above their 2% objective, which is the right approach. I mean, they should try to make up for a little bit of lost ground over the last few years, because the U.S. has had an inflation problem over the last several years, and inflation has been too low. And finally, now we're starting to have an economy that's growing quickly enough where we're absorbing resource slack and putting some upper pressure on inflation. So now with inflation right around 2%, you know, the Fed can turn their attention to make sure that the labor market doesn't overheat. And why I think the Fed likely viewed the June employment report as welcome news is that, you know, the rise in the unemployment rate is going to be temporary, but it does buy them a little bit of time, because if the unemployment rate continues to fall, the Fed's going to get increasingly nervous that the labor market's going to blow well past their estimate of full employment, which already is by their calculations. And returning an economy to full employment without triggering a recession is very, very difficult for the Fed to do. And typically, one good recession indicator is the unemployment rate. So when the unemployment rate rises 30 to 40 basis points on a 3-month moving average basis, a recession typically follows. Now, it's not imminent, but a recession does ensue. The other thing is, when the unemployment rate bottoms, a recession is usually 10 months away. But I don't think the increase in the unemployment rate in June signals that the unemployment rate has bottomed for this cycle. I think we have at least another year for the unemployment rate to decline. But, you know, the Fed, they're going to keep very close attention. They don't want the labor market to overheat. They don't want inflation to noticeably overshoot their 2% target. So I think a reasonable threshold would be 2.5% on the core PCE. If we start to flirt with that, then the Fed's going to turn more hawkish. And the other thing the Fed's paying close attention to is financial market conditions. They don't want imbalances to begin to develop in financial markets. But at least from a historical perspective, it's very difficult to identify in real time asset bubbles. And usually the bubbles begin to become very, very clear when the Fed is raising interest rates. And when the cycle's near its peak, the interest rate cycle, that's when bubbles begin to pop. So the tough task for the Fed is really ahead of them for the next couple of years.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, you mentioned the influence that monetary policy is having on this, and some of the Fed's considerations. Where does the yield curve fit into this discussion? Because it is continuing to flatten. Do you think that that is a sign that we are getting to the point where, you know, eventually we'll reach that inversion whenever that's going to happen? And then at that point, you know, signs of recession are much more baked in the cake. What are your thoughts on the standpoint of the yield curve continuing to flatten?
Yeah, I was always taught not to bash the yield curve because it's always been a very good predictor of recessions, but I'm going to bash it. And I think this time is a little bit different, and that I don't think the slope of the yield curve is accurately reflecting the state of the economy or the economy's near-term prospects, because long-term rates are no longer truly a risk-free rate, because not only the Fed, but other central banks, the European Central Bank, Bank of Japan, Bank of England, global quantitative easing has put downward pressure on long-term rates in the U.S. So at its peak, global QE reduced the U.S. 10-year yield by a full percentage point. That's a significant amount. And given that central banks' balance sheets are still very elevated, including the Fed's, you know, that's continued to depress long-term rates. And you can see that very clearly in the term premium, which is the extra compensation that investors need to hold long-term rates versus short-term rates. And currently, that's still negative. And historically, you know, a term premium average of roughly 50-100 basis points. So we have some room to rise in the term premium, but I think global central banks are continuing to depress the term premium. And that's preventing long-term rates from rising. And the Fed is continuing to forge ahead with rate hikes. You are seeing the flattening in the yield curve. Now, the one you see mostly quoted is the spread between the 10-year and the 2-year. I'm not a big fan of that one because it has sent a lot more false signals in the past than the 10-year minus the 3-month treasury bill rate or the 10-year minus the Fed funds rate. If you look at the 10-year minus the Fed funds rate, we're not nearly as close to an inversion as if you look at the 10 minus the 2-year. Now, yield curve is going to continue to flatten, I think, and we likely will see an inversion between the 10-year and the 2-year, maybe late this year, early next. And even though if you buy into my story that the yield curve is sending a misleading signal, there's still some psychological aspects to that. And if the yield curve does invert and the Fed purposely inverts the yield curve, you know, there could be some economic and financial costs in that when you do get an inversion, businesses, investors, consumers may then start to assume that a recession is inevitable. But right now, you know, I wouldn't worry too much about the flattening of the yield curve, particularly when you look at two golden eras of economic activity in the U.S., the late 1990s and also the mid to late 1960s, the yield curve was flat as a pancake then, and the economy continued to grow above its potential growth rate for some time.
Okay, so overall message, it sounds like things are generally looking positive for the U.S. for the remainder of 2018 and into 2019, but that's at the point where we should start to see some of these tailwinds that are currently present shift over into headwinds with weakness expected for 2020. That's the overall takeaway as I see it. And Ryan, I want to thank you for coming on the show today and speaking with us. It's always a pleasure having you on. We look forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks again for having me.
So once again, that was Ryan Sweet, Director of Real-Time Economics at Moody's Analytics, and also ranked as one of the most accurate high-frequency forecasters of the U.S. economy, according to MarketWatch. And I'm going to just run through a number of different charts that we look at Financial Sense Wealth Management when it comes to a number of things that we did discuss in today's interview. The Financial Sense Fed Funds Risk Neutral Index, developed by Chris Paplaw, but a look at whether or not the Fed is in danger of breaking the markets. That is currently showing that the Fed is still in a relatively loose posture when you compare where the Fed funds rate is relative to U.S. economic growth rates and also inflation rates. Once that ticks above the zero line, that shows that we're getting much closer into recessionary territory, or at least another way of putting it is that the Fed is in danger of breaking the market, something that you'll hear us talk about on the show. So we'll have a chart of that where this interview is located at Financial Sense if you want to take a look at that. Also, as you mentioned, you know, you can look at unemployment rate. It's a pretty good leading indicator or signal for if we're going to see any imminent signs of recession. I have a chart of U.S. initial jobless claims. And if you look at that, we have not seen a bottoming in that and then a tick up. That's something that we typically see before a recession. As long as that is still trending down, that is the number of people filing for unemployment. That's jobless claim. As long as that is continuing to trend down, meaning that people are not filing for unemployment, the signs of recession or the risk of recession is quite low. So that is a very good indicator that you can look at. It's very cyclical, seeing highs and lows that correspond to highs and lows in the market. That continues to trend down, which is positive, as Ryan mentioned. Also, if you look at manufacturing and non-manufacturing data in the economy, those are also sitting near record levels for this economic cycle. That tends to trend down prior to recession. So at current levels, that is indicating that no real risk of recession here in the U.S. U.S. is doing good. Small business sentiment is still near record levels. That's something that we typically see mid-cycle or even the beginning of an economic cycle. So that is a very interesting thing. When we think about the inflationary outlook, as we've explained on FS Insider and a number of other podcasts that we do here, inflation has basically a two-year lag over the ISM manufacturing PMI. And given how strong manufacturing has been, that is showing that inflationary pressures will continue to increase in agreement with what Ryan stated, and that we should be looking at overheating conditions in 2019. And that's the point where we start to see a number of these present tailwinds shift into headwinds. And that's when we will now probably start getting more concerned about the Fed breaking the market. So that's one thing to keep in consideration. Lastly, financial conditions, as Ryan mentioned, still generally healthy. We can also see that from a financial stress composite that we developed, looking at a number of different financial stress indicators. That is also presently in fairly positive territory, not giving us any red flags on the overall outlook. We did see that dip into the red actually in 2007 as the market peaked. We're still very far away from that. So these are some of the things that you look at. If you want to take a look at any of those different charts that I mentioned, they're all going to be located at financialsense.com, and you can go to the Financial Sense NewsHour page and click where this interview is located. We'll have the chart pack located there. If you have any questions or comments on what we discussed with Ryan or any of our other experts, always feel free to email us. You can email me directly. My email address is cris@financialsense.com. You have been listening to Financial Sense NewsHour.
Well, for the first half of 2018, emerging markets are down almost 8%. Emerging market currencies are also down big this year if you've been watching them, and bonds haven't fared too well either. About the only thing going up so far are the FANG stocks. That's the subject of conversation coming up next with Chris Paplava of Financial Sense Wealth Management. What does this mean in terms of the big picture and your investments? That's on the big picture coming up next on the Financial Sense NewsHour at financialsense.com.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertised with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.